The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 60.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. And this one, it's just going to be me talking about Dave Chappelle's show, Sticks and Stones. I know a lot of people have been talking about it, and I thought, you know, since I do have a few what I believe are unique things to say about it, I better hurry up and get the show on the road before this gets to be old news. That's so September Murphy. So something, well, let me preface this by saying, if you're on the fence and you think you're going to watch it, there's going to be some spoilers in my discussion here. And I'm the kind of guy, this is what I do. If I know I'm going to see a movie like the new Star Wars movie, and yeah, people, oh, these movies are terrible. Partly why you think they're bad is because you're comparing them to like one of the best movies of all time, at least American movie, namely The Empire Strikes Back. So yeah, anything they make in the series is not going to be as good as The Empire Strikes Back just because it's hard to make a movie that's better than The Empire Strikes Back, all right? Anyway, so if I know I'm seeing a movie that's coming out, I will allow myself to watch one trailer and then I cut myself up because I don't want to get spoilers, right? The function of trailers is to get you to say, maybe I will watch that movie. So it's a commercial. If you already know you're going to see it, then why in the world would you watch any trailers? So now the reason I allow myself one is it's a naughty treat. That's what it is. But strictly speaking, somebody who had the discipline to say, no, I just go in the theater. I have no idea what to expect. You know, all those scenes are new to me. That would be amazing if you had that kind of discipline. I salute you, sir. So anyway, if you're on the fence and you're going to watch this thing, it's perfectly fine. I think some people are overrating it, and there's sort of this backlash effect of because the official outlets were telling us how, oh, this is tired and hackneyed. Is that the way you say it? I've never heard someone say that phrase. I've just seen it in print. I think it's hackneyed. Then that made the people who were on board with his message support it. Sort of like, I'll say this while I'm thinking of it, going off on a tangent here. It occurred to me a little bit ago that if people had reacted to Trump in a normal fashion, that would have limited his power, right? The reason some of the people who support Trump are doing it so vociferously and apparently without any reservation is because the attacks on him are so unhinged, all right? So I'm not, again, let's be clear. I'm not saying, oh, I sound like I'm saying, just don't resist and it'll go well for you. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying, though, is object to stuff that's actually really a big deal and don't, like, for example, lie and say Trump called Nazis very fine people when he clearly did not. He literally denounced them in that press conference. And the reporter even asked him, wait a minute, are you saying it was the alt-right and the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis that you're defending or saying were being mistreated? And he said, no, I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the people who wanted the Confederate statue to not be taken. So anyway, I just made Trump start turning into Bernie Sanders there. Interesting. So I'm saying that's the kind of thing. If the criticisms against Trump from day one had been about stuff that was legitimately bad and they hadn't made up 2 years plus of this wild goose chase of a secret Manchurian candidate, then I think some of Trump's supporters would not be so diehard. But it's in the face of this relentless mob that is without mercy or reasons, full of passion, that his defenders adopt similar tactics. Okay, so likewise with Chappelle's show, I think because the attacks on it were so over the top and uncalled for, that I think some people then might be exaggerating about how funny it was. I went in thinking it was going to be awesome, you know, because I'm familiar with his work. I'm not like an expert on Dave Chappelle, but I've seen his stuff before and I thought this was going to be better than it was. In contrast, I was on like a Netflix binge. I watched Joe Rogan and Colin Quinn. Now, theirs isn't new. It was older. I didn't realize how old, like Rogan's, I think was a year old. And I was amazed. Joe Rogan was way better at stand-up than I thought he was going to be. and Colin Quinn was way better. I had somehow pigeonholed Colin Quinn as being like, hey, I'm an angry guy. I'm from Jersey or something. And, you know, whatever he used to do on Saturday Night Live is what I was picturing. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised. So anyway, it's not that I'm impossible to please is what I'm saying. I'm saying of that, I went in and Chappelle kind of underwhelmed me and the other guys blew me away. But if you're going to watch it, go ahead and watch it before you listen to this. So anyway, the first thing I want to talk about is he had this great bit on abortion. I don't mean it was funny. I mean, it was funny, but I'm saying the reason I called it great was he made some kind of mildly sexist joke, I believe. I haven't reviewed this, so I was going off the memory of when I just watched it the first time, first and only time. And so, like, it's like the audience, the women in the audience might be a little bit, you know, on their guard and a little bit, you know, upset with him. And so then he tries to diffuse, or that's what it seems he's doing. He diffuses it by saying, now, ladies, I'm obviously this is all paraphrasing. I'm not even doing an impression of Chappelle. He goes, now, ladies, I want to be clear. You know, it's a woman's body. It's her body. It's her choice. And men, when it comes to abortion, y'all need to shut the F up or, you know, something like that. Okay. But it was so without nuance and it was just so in your face and sort of like lazy, I guess, like just sloganeering that I knew, okay, this he's doing something with this. This is not him just speaking from the heart. He's setting them up for something and I wasn't sure what. And my instincts were correct because he dwells on that a little bit, just establishing how women, you know, if it's inconvenient for you, you know, it's up to you. No outsider has the right to tell you about that important decision. And so if you want to or not, you know, you get to decide. And then, you know, he lets that sink in. And then he goes to, and likewise, if you do decide, you know, to have the baby, then it's up to me about whether or not I want to pay child support. And so then the audience, of course, is like, oh, because they realize what he did with it. And then he hits him with the amazing summary. In one sentence, he distills that whole chain of thought or train of thought, chain of reasoning into one sentence beautifully. And he says, because if you can kill it, I should be able to abandon it. All right. He that might not be exact quote. It might be something like, you know, if you have the right to kill it, then I should have the right to abandon or then I have the right to abandon, something like that. But do you see how he just boom? And, you know, and he moved on, but I really think that's brilliant. So again, what this might not be exactly, but let's say that's what it was. The principle that he enunciated being something like saying, ladies, if you have the right to kill it, then men should have the right to abandon it. Right. And my point is, how can anyone possibly argue with that? So to be clear, I'm against abortion and I'm for men having at least a very strong moral duty to pay child support. With all this stuff, it's going to be tricky for me to even talk about it, folks, because as you know, I'm an anarcho-capitalist in the Rothbardian tradition, so I don't think there should be a coercive state at all. So it's a little bit murky, like for me to make distinctions between stuff that, you know, should be legally enforced. Do I mean by the police? I don't want the police as run by the government to do anything. But, you know, for them saying, oh, in a free society, what would the police type companies do there? So in any event, without me taking a strong stand on the legality of things, let me say that morally, yeah, I think abortion is wrong. And I think it would be wrong for a man to father a child and not, you know, not support the child's upbringing and being a part of the kid's life. Certainly if the mother, you know, doesn't fear for her safety or something. Okay, so those are my views there. So when I'm analyzing Chappelle, I'm not saying I endorse the premise or the conclusion, but I'm saying his logic of the if-then seems pretty powerful. So powerful, in fact, at least at a prima facie level, I would be curious to hear, you know, a standard pro-choice, pro-fathers have to pay child support, throw those deadbeats in jail if they try to welch. I can't believe these guys running around town getting young girls pregnant and then just walking away. Let's bring the law into this. I would be curious to hear them elaborate on why they disagree with that if-then proposition. Because they do think my body, my choice. And so again, it's interesting that, okay, so if they elect then to bring the child into the world, why do they get 100% of the decision-making over how both of those people's bodies are to be used? Because that's the crucial thing. The guy, yeah, he doesn't have to suffer for 9 months from morning sickness and, you know, getting fat and sluggish and having to pee every 10 minutes and all that stuff. But on the other hand, he has to go to work and give over a chunk of his income for 18 years. So yes, any given moment of pregnancy is worse than the guy having to work, unless he was in a really awful job. But there is the whole 9 months versus 18 years thing too. And so it does seem interesting, right? The way Chappelle put it is he said, my money, my choice. I forgot about that. So he took the my body, my choice. My money, my choice. So anyway, I would be curious to see. And think of it too, to give it a little extra oomph. It's true. I could imagine a woman saying, again, not just any old woman, but the woman who agrees with the premise, or even a guy. There's no reason people of the opposite sex can't have an opinion on this. And I'm sure there's plenty of men who would say, oh no, I'm pro-choice and I'm, you know, for those deadbeat dads is getting cracked down upon. Because that's the irony in all this thing, is that the typical pro-choice feminist does not at all have a problem with the government forcing you to do things with your body against your will. So the classic example here, it was on Twitter a while ago, and some guy who was just, you know, kissing up to the women was, so some woman tweeted something about, you know, some bill trying to restrict abortion privileges. I won't call it right. Right. And so I don't know if it was Alyssa Milano, but it was something like someone like that was tweeting about it. And then I saw a guy in the comments say something like, I can't even imagine what it must feel like to have the government interfering with your body in this way. You know, we men should just stay out of it. He said something like that. And so I went and got a screenshot of the Selective Service homepage, you know, that said right there that all males upon their 18th birthday must register for the draft. And I sent him a screenshot and I was like, bad news, dude. I garnered quite a few hearts. That guy didn't like it. And what was funny there too, it was like the stupidity and the weakness of the responses from the pro-choice people who thought, you know, my line was stupid and childish. And the primary argument that I saw that they cited was, oh, well, no, they actually ended the draft, whatever, back in the 70s. So that doesn't apply. The government's actually not drafting you, so that's not an issue. You know, and it's like, yeah, I'm sure if Jesse Helms had pushed through a national registry that all women upon turning 18 have to register their wombs with Washington, D.C. in case it's called upon in a fertility emergency. Oh, but we actually haven't forcibly impregnated you. So not now, it's, you know, it's just a hypothetical. You don't need to worry. Yeah, I'm sure Gloria Steinem and all them, oh, that's cool. But the moment you pull the trigger and you actually call up these women to go have, you know, fertilized eggs inserted into their bodies against their will, and we just strap them down for 9 months as incubators, you know, when you actually start doing that, then we're going to object. But just right now, you're just having a selective service of females. That's fine. I don't think that would be their response. So of course, there it was crystal clear to me that these people, they didn't view the military draft as the government telling men, here's what we're going to do with your body, whether you like it or not. And of course, you know, taxation would be even one more level of abstractness and moving the ball away from the goal. So they clearly wouldn't see that as partial slavery. But it was interesting to see that. So where I'm coming from is, at least with somebody like Murray Rothbard or Walter Block, with his evictionism views about abortion, even though I disagree with Walter on that stuff, I can see how that actually is an understandable, logical application of his principle. And he's consistent, right? So he is not, you know, for the same reason that a government, in Walter Block's view, can't force a woman to have a baby she doesn't want to bring to term. By the same token, if a business owner doesn't want to serve Jewish people, Walter Block's not going to sue them. He's going to be delighted and say, ah, yes, the heroic anti-Semite. I'll put you as a chapter in my book, right? Because again, Walter would say the business owner has the right to do with his property whatever he wants, even if it's something that a bunch of people find morally repugnant. Likewise, this woman has the right to do with her body what she wants, even if a bunch of people find it morally repugnant, because Walter has a consistent set of principles that he applies. Like, now, I've publicly criticized him, meaning I've, you know, written like his heroic counterfeiter chapter in his Defending the Undefendable. I think that's wrong. I'll put a link to that. I think that's more academic than I intended. So I'm not saying Walter is right in the application of his principles. But at least he's trying, and at least prima facie, you can see how, oh yeah, that I see where you're going with that. I think you just misapplied. Whereas clearly, when it comes to the abortion stuff, people use types of arguments there that they would never dream of deploying anywhere else. Like, my body, my choice. No. Everybody except radical libertarians rejects the notion that your body, your choice. Whether it comes to, you know, vaccinations, taxation, jury duty, the military draft, as we already said, using, you know, recreational drugs or even drugs that are experimental. You know, you got late stage cancer and there's this new drug that might help you. Nope, the FDA might not let you do it. It might be illegal for someone to give you that drug. They're going to protect you by having you die because you might hurt yourself if you take that experimental drug for your cancer. Right? So no, we do not at all have enshrined in our public policy right now, my body, my choice. The one area is when it comes to killing a fetus. That's the one area where the rights of the individual trump the general, you know, social effects of your actions. So if you want to hire a worker for $3 an hour, no, that could have negative consequences on others, the poor and defenseless, the relatively helpless. But you want to flush a fetus out of your body, more power to you. Who are we to infringe on your autonomy as a sovereign individual? We don't do that here in the United States, right? So you can see there's just a huge clash there in the justifications. So what Chappelle did, perhaps without realizing what a big can of worms he was opening there, was just highlight the hypocrisy of the standard. I was going to say progressive, but I don't want to make this just about progressive because it's the person who's pro-choice might not even, you know, they might call themselves a centrist or something. So we'll leave it at that. Folks, let's take a break from my discussion of Dave Chappelle's show to once again make you aware that I would like your money. And so if you want to contribute, go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. The more you give, the more you get. Thanks, everybody. Now, let me offer a note of criticism. There was one of Chappelle's bits that got a great reaction from the crowd, but I think it was fundamentally bogus. It was like the whole premise, the whole foundation of the joke is utter BS. And it was kind of annoying to me. So just part, you know, you're learning a lot about Bob in this episode. Among other things, apparently I refer to myself in the third person. I didn't mean to do that. It's kind of weird. It's weird. It's wacky. I did not know that. So what he did, or what I was going to tell you about myself, is that I don't like it when people criticize me for something I didn't do, right? Like on Twitter, a lot of times I'll make some point along the lines of, oh, the government should, you know, stop subsidizing such and such. I was going to say invariably that's not true, but let's say 4 times out of 10, if I get pushback on it, it will be of the form, oh yeah, that's easy for you to say as a tenured college professor. And I'm going to say, for the record, I never had tenure. So there. So it's kind of, because it's clear too, like these people, it's not like the kind of guy that says that understands the distinction between an associate and an assistant and a visiting professor, you know, all those fine things. They have no clue. Yeah, you go to work for the college and they pay you forever because you're just a bunch of Ivory Tower twits. Can't change a tire. I'm not sure what I was just doing an impression of. Right. So that's the reaction I get a lot. And that really bothers me. Because it, besides it being a non sequitur, but it's just like, no, I'm not tenured. And and then what is even more infuriating, it'll be something like with, you know, me arguing for free trade. That's like, because usually I don't actually talk about cutting off foods. You know, I don't really talk like that much. But if I'm talking about like how outsourcing is actually efficient and tariffs are bad, you know, that kind of stuff, somebody will say, yeah, it's easy for you college tenured professors to talk like that because you got, you know, a guaranteed spot. The hard guy working out in the factory, you know, you don't know what it's like. And so then one time I remember in crisp detail, I said to the guy, I was literally in the process of moving because the spot that I had at a college was dried up and I needed to go somewhere else. You know, I mean, they didn't have room for me. And so I was going somewhere else. And I said that to the guy. I was like, it's funny you say that because no, I don't have tenure. And I actually am driving to a different city right now because I got to, you know, you got to get to go where the job is. And so, yeah, I understand that it can be tough. You got to pick up your family sometimes and move across the country. I'm doing that right now. And so instead of the guy saying, oh, geez, wow, I didn't realize that. I guess maybe you do understand. Maybe you actually believe in the principles of freedom that you espouse. You're not a hypocrite. No, he just said something like, well, not my fault that you didn't apply for the right spot or, you know, you didn't engage in better planning. Something like that. Like he turned it into an insult. Like it was a sign of my incompetence or something. It was like, you bastard. You just So either way, I can't win. If I'm a 10 years, then it shows I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm out of touch. If I'm actually going through the struggle that he said I had no understanding of, he then criticizes me for being a loser. I was like, jeez, tough crowd, am I right? So anyway, my point being, I don't like criticism in general, but I'm saying I really don't like it if the premise upon which it is based is bogus. That's annoying. And so that's why this one bit from Chappelle really bugged me. And I to the point where I was like, you know what, if I talk about this episode or this special, I'm gonna bring this up. Not that this would have justified a whole discussion on its own. So anyway, the bit goes, and I just a little back story here, if you understand the inside baseball of how the Bob Murphy Show was made. I had toyed with like playing part of it and then bleeping out. But, you know, if you had kids in the car or something, like you could still tell what the word was going to be. And then I thought about like being funny and making words that rhymed with it, but weren't naughty words. And I was like, no, because you would still know what I was going to, it would sound like I was trying to say the slur without saying it. So I then even toyed with doing a different analogy, like, because as you'll see, trust me, folks, when you hear me paraphrase the bit, you'll get what I'm talking about here with these analogies and stuff. It'll make more sense. Just hang on. But I was thinking about doing something like, you know, him saying, oh, I'm not Starscream. And then, or Dave, you're not Starscream. And then what, saying, oh, but I'm not a Decepticon or something like that. You'll see where I'm going with it. Or having a poodle that's a dog. So coming up with like nested hierarchies. And I was going to do an analogy so that there'd be nothing offensive in the joke and we could just discuss it. But then I was like, no, because if people haven't heard his joke, they're not going to get it. Like, it's going to be too hard to translate. They're going to miss it. So after all of these pros and cons and weighing of the different options, I've decided to paraphrase it in the following fashion. I am going to substitute the word knife for a different word. And I am going to substitute the word fork for a different word. And the words for which they're being substituted have the same initial sound. Okay. And so what Chappelle was talking, he's telling this story about the Chappelle show and how one time they had written up a skit that got approved and everything. And it involved a slur that's commonly used for gay people. For our purposes here, let's say that sometimes people refer to gay people as forks. Okay. And so the lady in whatever human resources calls him in. It might have been her. It might have been like compliance. I don't remember what her department was, but it's this lady. I'm assuming she was white. Calls him in and says, "Dave, we saw your skit for tonight, and this one's troubling us. There's no way we're letting you go out there and say the word fork. That's not going to happen." And so he's, "Well, why not? Why can't I say it?" And she says, "No, it's against our policy, or whatever." And then he agrees with her. And they says, "Wait a minute, you have no problem. You let me say on my show, you let me say the word knife all the time. And you don't have a problem with that. But a lot of people in this country think that knife is a very offensive term. And yet you let me say that word left, right, and center. So why the disparity?" And she said, "Well, because Dave, you're not gay. That's why you can't say fork." And so then, you know, there's a beat. And then Dave goes, "Well, Cheryl, I'm not a knife either." And everyone's like, "Oh," and clapping and stuff. All right. So I'll pause for a second. Let me say it again. He had a sketch that was full of the word fork. They called him in and said, "No, that's going to offend gay people. You can't say that." And then he said, "Wait a minute. You have no problem with me using the word knife all the time, calling black people knife. And so what gives?" And then she said, "Well, the difference is you're not gay. That's why you can't say fork." And then he said, "Well, I'm not a knife either." And everybody went nuts. Okay, so you get the joke. And I want to just make the modest point. That is completely bogus. Because he didn't articulate it explicitly. But clearly what exudes, what oozes out from that whole anecdote is that these hypocritical white people with their suits and their rules, they're perfectly okay for me to go out and use the N-word. That's fine with them, but they won't let me use this other word because, you know, really they're more concerned about protecting gay people than they are concerned about the plight of black people. No, that's not what happened there, Mr. Chappelle, and anybody who thought his joke was awesome. What happened there was the lady was explaining what the rules were. The white heterosexual men aren't allowed to use any of these terms whatsoever. But the groups for whom the slurs historically applied, or to whom they were historically applied, we have been told, and I said, I count myself among the people who can't do anything.
We are the pirates who don't do anything.
We have been told that it's acceptable for the groups in question to use the term to refer to themselves if they so choose. But like Richard Pryor can certainly come back and say, no, I realized I'm not using that word anymore. She's fine. He no longer refers to knives. That's fine. So it's your tongue, your choice, if you're the relevant subgroup. Again, white heterosexual males are not allowed to say anything except we're sorry. So that's fine. And this lady was consistently applying that rule. He came in and said, he wanted to use the slur for a group of which he was not a member. And no, that's not allowed. And again, these aren't our rules, folks. These are the rules that those who thought Dave's joke was funny decided upon. Okay, consistent. And why is Dave allowed to use it? Because he's black. So notice that's the analog. The lady did not say you can't use the word fork because you're not a fork. That would have been offensive, right? If she had said that in a meeting with the guy, he would have said, whoa, you can't talk like that. That's a slur. You see, because she wouldn't have been using it as a quote for saying you can't use this word in the sketch because, and then now she's talking, right? And so again, what she said to Dave Chappelle was, you can't use the word fork because you're not gay. She didn't say because you're not a fork, right? So then when Dave comes back and says, well, I'm not a knife either, she should say, right, I never said you were. You said you were, but I never said you were. Now, if you asked me, Dave, why are you okay with me using the word knife? Then she could have just said, because you're black. And he couldn't have flipped out. That's the rule as told to white people by black people, right? So again, these are the rules you guys gave us. So fine, slavery sucked. You know, go ahead. You can tell us how the word's going to be used. But then you can't complain when we use it in exactly the fashion that you told us to. Or when we merely tell you what the rules are to repeat them back to you as they were explained to us by you and by gay people. So I'm just clarifying. All right. So there you go. So Rachel in Human Resources or whatever her name was, Cheryl, Rachel, something like that. White woman. By the way, let me just mention, I understand that groups that were historically oppressed need to, or at least many could understandably have thought, the way to rectify those imbalances is to have, I don't want to say affirmative action because people are going to think I mean a very particular thing, but sort of going out of your way to recognize achievements and things like that, you know, so to have Black History Month and so forth. And that's fine. And men's rights activists, that whole notion makes me kind of squeamish, right? So, yeah, I think guys get it treated unfairly with child support and, you know, parental visitation, all that stuff. But I would never call myself a men's rights activist. That's just not, I don't know, I would just feel funny doing that. All right. So there you go. You know, and this, I'm not one to go on the internet and be like, most of the rape victims are men. And like, I get people who do it. And if you want to do it, that's fine. If you want to pick those fights, but it's just not something I get into because I understand. Yeah. Historically white heterosexual male Christians, I'll even add that, did a lot of bad stuff. And so, yeah, I get that. But my point is on Twitter lately, I've seen the reaction against it now where I saw a woman I know on Twitter was chimed, like some black woman had tweeted something. Some white lady that I know, responded civilly, but criticized her. And the lady's response was something like, oh, great, getting lectured by a white woman. And yes, I could tell that was the way she said it from her tweet. And her friends like joined in too. And were like, oh, they're the worst. Then she said, oh, she's even a libertarian too. You know, so at least there, I guess you could say that was at least ideological. So they weren't judging her based on her DNA. But I mean, it wasn't like playful. You know what I mean? Like some of it, it's kind of annoying. I don't think it's that funny, but some of it's fine. You know, like white lady starter set. It shows, you know, them drinking fruity wine or something, whatever. But you know that how there's a whole thing about what white women do and what white guys do or whatever. Fine. That's fine. But I'm saying here, this wasn't charming. It was literally you're offering an opinion and you're a white woman. No. And also too, by the way, it wasn't like she was talking about her experience watching Roots or something. I mean, it had nothing to do with race per se. So that's why, you know, the other woman being white had nothing to do with it. And this lady was just, no, you're white, so why would your opinion possibly matter to me? And I'm just going to mention, whatever the line is, wherever you thought it should have been, we have way crossed it by now. I mean, it's not even close in terms of now that's doing more harm than good. That's sowing division and is fostering hatred. And it's leading us towards a less civil society. So the last thing I'd like to talk about is the whole point, of course, of Chappelle's show is Sticks and Stones. And he's got a great thing early on where he says, I'm going to do some impressions. And he does one that's racially charged. And then he does where he uses the utensil word. And then he does an impression and he says, like, I'm going to watch your career. And if you ever screw up once, you're finished. You're never going to work in this town again. He goes, you know who that is? And the other's like, what? He goes, it's you. That's what you sound like to me. Okay, again, I'm paraphrasing. What he said was a bit funnier. All right, and so that's where he's coming from with the Sticks and Stones. And so he got the reaction he wanted. You're helping Chappelle when you freak out about his special and, you know, call for trying to give it 0% on Rotten Tomatoes and all that kind of stuff and having certain places maybe not want to carry it. So that's what he wanted. And for there, you know, I salute him, take my hat off to him. And some people, I saw criticism saying things along the lines of, oh, he was just purposely being edgy just to be edgy or whatever. And unfortunately, he needed to do that. Some comedian needed to be the one to do that. The reason it needed to be a comedian was that if it were somebody who had some other agenda besides just, no, entertainers should be able to say what they want to say without their careers being threatened. This is crazy, right? If it had been anybody else trying to enunciate the principle of free speech by applying it. And again, the only scenario in which it's important for everybody to concede, I'm going to use the right to free speech loosely. So, you know, I'm not talking here about the property rights per se that people are just trying to organize voluntary boycotts. For the purposes of this podcast episode, just go with me in terms of colloquial understanding, all right? I'm not going to get into hyper-fine distinctions about legal theory on this point, but you know what I'm talking about. So whether you want to say it's illegal or not, or still, if somebody makes a joke on Twitter that is not really that offensive in the grand scheme of things, and then the person just gets disappeared, that's crazy. Now, I'm not saying Twitter doesn't have the legal right to do that. I'm not calling for government regulation. I'm just saying that's crazy, right? I can call something crazy. I have the right to do that too, right? I own my tongue. So if Twitter has the right to take somebody down, I have the right to say, I think that's crazy. Okay. And by that, I don't mean to cast aspersions on those who are insane. So you see where I'm going with this, that Chappelle needed to be the one to do it, because if anybody else did it, like somebody on, you know, like when they're taking down Alex Jones, for example, and a lot of people could say, you know, I think that's went too far. And what's really creepy on YouTube, I don't know if you guys have seen this, there are still videos up on YouTube that mention Alex Jones, but only if they're critical of him. Right? I haven't checked this recently, but back when his stuff got taken down, my wife and I were just going around just out of curiosity. And as far as we could tell, only videos that were critical of Alex Jones were still up there. Right. So it would make sense if you took down everything that was just by Alex Jones, right, to try to make sure he's not profiting directly and then leave everything else up. Or it would make sense to just take down Alex Jones's stuff and then any videos that refer to him, you know, videos that are basically derivatives of Alex Jones. I could see taking them all down as a blanket rule. But what does not make any sense at all to me is to take down Alex Jones' original stuff and then anybody who's supportive of Alex Jones and take them down, but leave the critics up. That's nutty. And yet, I think that's what they did. So I'm saying the difficulty, though, where with jumping in and trying to defend him is then it's hard to divorce the abstract principle from the content of what he was saying. Because I think most of us have a line somewhere. I mean, you know, maybe Dave Smith doesn't. Maybe he would say, no, you want to have somebody up there. I don't even want to go there. Like, I'm trying to think of the kind of things somebody would need to want to put up on YouTube that even Dave would say, I think YouTube should take that down, would be pretty nasty. And I don't want to go there. Sort of like how Heath Ledger, when he was studying to be the Joker. by the way, folks, I'm not saying Dave Smith is evil and sadistic. I'm saying the kind of thing that would make Dave Smith say, yeah, Twitter should take that. That's what I'm saying. And so that's the beauty of Chappelle doing it. And what's also good is he managed to do it without actually being that offensive, right? Because I've seen comics do bits that I'm uncomfortable with. Like I could understand if somebody said, yeah, I find that offensive. Not that they're going to call the club owner and say, hey, I don't want you to hire this guy. But just to say, I'm not buying this guy's specials. You know, if he's headlining at a club, I'm not going to go that night. You know, just I'm withholding my money from this guy. I don't support him. I don't like what he stands for. You know, I think that's great. Fine for people to do that. But, and so that's the difficulty then when people do get taken down, it's, you know, a lot of times they're going to be kind of reprehensible or weird in some degree. And so you can understand why a lot of people might feel that way. So that's the beauty of Chappelle doing what he did, because say what you will about his special, but people shouldn't be freaking out about it. And so I think what he did, it was sort of like a Minimax strategy from Game Theory. I'm trying to be geeky here, folks. Because like a lot of your, I really tuned in for the economics. Don't care so much about what you think about a stand-up special. Where he wanted to do the very, you know, the minimum amount of offensiveness that would still get the result of him getting pushback, right? Because that's really the sweet spot. Because he got up there and just said a bunch of really horrendous stuff, and then people were panning it and saying he went too far, that wouldn't have proven that society is too uptight. People could have just said, no, Chappelle, you really said some awful things up there. Whereas for him to get up and say what he did say and for people to flip out, again, that's like when people, I'll give you another example about Trump and how the criticism of him was just so dumb. Remember when there was the solar eclipse and, you know, they're handing out all the glasses to all the kids in schools and everything. And then there was a picture, I don't know if you saw it, Trump standing out in like the outside the White House balcony or something with Melania. And it shows him holding the glasses in his hand and he's looking up at the sky. And all these people were so smart and tutting him. And oh, my God, what it? I was like, you idiots. Every single one of you looked up at the sky the day there was the eclipse with your bare eyes. You all did it. We all do that. Come on. Give me a break. And Trump did this. I mean, they're making it like he just sat there and pulled out a telescope or something. No, he looked up and the camera caught him. Everybody does that, right? And it's not like the sun gets more powerful when there's an eclipse. So when they say don't stare at it, it's just like on any normal day, don't stare at the sun. It's just that you wouldn't do it. You know, on a normal day, you wouldn't get the notion in your head, let me just try to stare at the sun until my eyes start bleeding. Which is also why it was goofy when people just think about it. I was saying, don't forget your pets. And they wanted to get like, don't bring your pets outside when there's the eclipse because your pets, you know, aren't going to have the goggles. As if your St. Bernard is going to notice, wow, the position of the moon and sun is precisely so. Okay. But that's what I mean about the ridiculous criticism of Trump. That was another example. And so that's what makes, like, I feel for the guy. Now I'm defensive. I'm protective of him. Because I've been swatting down so many stupid objections that now even when someone does say something perfectly valid, I'm kind of like, well, okay, yeah, fair enough. And so if your goal was to convince a bunch of people to hate Trump, the last thing in the world you want to do is to make a bunch of people rush to his defense as a knee-jerk reaction now because he's been the recipient of such BS attacks. Okay. So with Chappelle, that's what he does in this episode is he brilliantly came up with an act such that he elicited the response he wanted and made a point. And I think it will wake some people up to the fact that, yeah, this is kind of ridiculous. So he drew a line in the sand and now we're going to see which side do people line up on. And again, it was important for someone to do that. And so I do applaud him for that. More generally, I think it's amazing what's happened here. Probably a lot of you have thought of this, but I've never heard someone say it out loud. So I'll go ahead and do it. Notice how many comedians now are the ones that have to be offering commentary on politics. So the pioneer here, the Beatles of this genre is, I guess he would be Elvis, is Jon Stewart. Like what he did with The Daily Show was just amazing and we are forever in his debt. So number one, I think he's hilarious. If you don't like him, I think maybe you haven't seen the right skits. So I'm going to put some in the show notes page. So this is BobMurphyShow.com/60 if you want to look at these. I'll put some Jon Stewart clips in there. I heard people say, oh, yeah, he's always just so, you know, liberal in it. No, he had a hilarious takedown of Krugman. And he also, when Obama first came in and gave, I don't know if it was an inaugural speech, but you know, one of his early speeches, Stewart went through and showed side-by-side clips or back-to-back clips of George W. Bush and stuff he said, and then Obama saying the same stuff. And Stewart, you know, kind of throws his hands up at the end and say, so I guess if we got outraged at Bush whenever he said it, we should get outraged when Obama, but you know, I just, when Obama says those things, I don't think he believes it or something like that. You know, so he was basically saying he's just appealing to the voters. Don't worry. He's lying to us. So that's why we don't need to freak out the way we freaked out when George W. Bush said the exact same stuff. So that was hilarious, right? And it was, you know, self-deprecating and honest. So it was good stuff. But what John Stewart did was he showed that an audience is willing to sit there and listen to dry analysis of politics and even economics as long as you make it funny and punchy. And so, I mean, I learned from that. Like, that inspired me. I was like, oh, I can go there. I mean, because I, growing up, you know, I was called Bob the Brain as a kid and, you know, oh, I was a nerd or whatever. And I wasn't beaten up the way Tom Woods was because I was actually my current height by eighth grade. But, you know, I still walked around for a while thinking like, oh, yeah, if you're smart, just keep that to yourself or whatever. And then it sort of developed into, okay, yeah, you know, it's fine to be smart in school and that's cool. But in the real world out there, people, you know, they don't care about this boring economic stuff. They don't want to hear you talk about tax policy or monetary policy. And now I'm seeing counterexamples of that, right? It's just showing you can't talk about it the way a college professor normally gets up and lectures about it. Yes, that's too boring and people want to jump out a window. Don't start doing that at a cocktail party. But people, you know, Ron Paul showed he got college kids chanting "End the Fed." That's amazing. How did he do that? He probably wouldn't have gotten them chanting "Legalize weed," right? Even though you would have thought that'd be the easier sell because it wasn't idiosyncratic enough. And likewise, John Stewart, who would have thought playing clips from Fox News and making fun of their hypocrisy would get a younger crowd laughing and tuning in with enthusiasm? And so he did. Now, I think a lot of people would say, yeah, John Stewart, you know, got me to go, you know, vote again. And that's not, of course, what I think the end game is. But to the extent that it did stimulate some people and think, you know what, we should pay attention to this. These politicians are lying through their teeth and the corporate media is enabling them. That's good to get people thinking like that. And so obviously Dave Smith now is the prime example from our ranks, from the Liberty Movement, of someone who is able to talk about very dry stuff at a pretty good level and still make it very entertaining. It's great. I've noticed too that Colin Quinn in his stand-up special and was very much, you know, that was the whole thing was political. I was shocked that he even, like, that's more political than I would do if I were going to do it an hour somewhere. Like, that's when I used to do the Bob Murphy show, or when I call it the Bob Murphy variety show at Porkfest. It wasn't as overtly political as, and, you know, and as serious as Colin Quinn's was. I was amazed. And so it's, you know, just showing that's possible, right? So that was great. And I noticed Bill Burr, he backed off of it. All right, so I was watching a bunch of his clips with my son, and I don't remember which stand-up special it was, but at one point, he did start talking about how the money wasn't backed up by gold. And he was using it like putting it into the word, in the mouth, those words in the mouth of like a crazy guy you're sitting next to at the bar or something. But even though he tried to make it as gentle as that and like just packed as one detail into a broader joke about going to the bar and talking to crazy people, maybe I was just reading into it because I was sensitive. But I really think Burr kind of lost the crowd, right? So he just has him eating out of the palm of his hand because, you know, every 2 minutes or so, he just has a laugh out loud, hilarious joke as he's telling stories and, you know, just delivering his trains of thought. So he's got the audience by this point in the show completely doing whatever he wants. Like they're, you know, they're just at his beck and call. And then, like I said, he brings up the fact that, yeah, you know, the money's not backed by anything. And it kind of just deadened the crowd a little bit. And I think they felt like, oh, wait a minute, is this school? You know? So that's the thing that I think, like, the audience does not want to have to think. They want to just laugh and have a good time. And so I think for somehow Bill Burr, like, and he backed off right away and moved on to his other material. So those are some examples of what I'm talking about, just showing how, and then going the other way, right? Like at Mises University, the lectures there are funny. They're really good. And I think as we keep doing it, you know, we're all watching each other and it kind of just raises the bar a little bit. You know what I mean? Like everyone's saying, oh yeah, that's so much better if instead of just going through the material, you also open with a joke and you know, every 5 minutes or so you say something funny and get the crowd to laugh. That's much more pleasant. You can get the, you know, so we're all learning from each other and just keep trying to make the thing more entertaining. And the fact that it's, you know, put online and stuff like that, that makes, you know, more pressure and more desire to do a good job and to make it entertaining. And so they're all sort of converging. And that's great now with the being able to podcast, you know, very low barriers to entry is what I'm getting at. That you can self-publish books now. I mean, just the way somebody who doesn't need to, or someone who has something he wants to say to the world doesn't need to spend that much money to make it pretty professional in terms of the quality of the end product. And that's amazing. And I think we're just, even now, at the early stages of that. And over time, that's just going to grow. And I think that'll just fundamentally change the way information is transferred. And we're still just experimenting. This is like the Wild West, as it were, of that new genre. And so all these other podcasters have to keep raising the bar, right? Got to put on a show for everybody. So you got Dave Smith over there, you know, great analysis. And he's got to just casually, in quotation mark, work in his Bernie Sanders impressions. Because he knows that's what's going to keep the people from changing the station, hitting the advance key.
So, folks, I'm going to raise your taxes. I'm Bernie Sanders. My name is Dave Smith.
And if he gets to be a Christian conservative podcaster, then I get to be a Jewish comedian from Brooklyn, right? Fair is fair.
Folks, I'd like to get serious for a minute. In this city, every 5 minutes, a man is beaten by a Trump supporter. Now, I don't know who this guy is. If he doesn't start making friends, he's going to get himself killed. Folks, I come home from the club the other day, and I find my running mate in bed with MMT. I says, Ocasio, I have to, but you...
You see what I mean? You see the lengths I have to go to compete? It's, well, what am I supposed to do here? It's not enough. I wrote the study guide for human action. You people want more. What have I done for you lately? So as I say, this is the function of the court jester. There's this famous quote, if you want to tell people the truth, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. So this has been attributed to George Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, I think probably even Winston Churchill, stuff like that. I think I even saw someone say John Lennon said it. So I went and tried to nail it. I think if you had to guess, it'd be George Bernard Shaw, but really the evidence that it was attributed to him earlier than anybody else, but that was still like 50 years after he died or something. But in any event, it's a nice little saying, isn't it? I'll say it again. If you want to tell people the truth, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. Okay. And so that's why the court jester plays such an important role in human affairs. That, you know, even like if there's a despotic king, the king, if he's smart, see, this is the thing. This isn't like some concession to the people. The king, if he's smart and wise, actually, it's more about wisdom than being smart, will allow a court jester and allow him to say whatever he wants. And actually, you know, the more he's allowed to get away with, the better. Because you want to maintain your humility, the ability to laugh at yourself, to realize if you did something silly, that to have it pointed out to you. You don't want to have absolute power. That will mess you up. And you'll make horrible decisions after a while. Likewise, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I like the principle of that, right? So I can't stand the media, and I understand it's self-congratulatory and all that stuff. But the idea that, yeah, the president goes to this thing and someone gets up there and just rips on the president to his face, that's good, that aspect of it. And so this is why... You know, that's why Chappelle had to do it. I realize I'm taking a long time to circle back to that point. It needed to be done by someone who was not partisan, right? Because otherwise you'd be worried about an agenda. So now, I mean, because now the deal is if someone on the right gets taken down from Twitter, the leftists are fine with it because, oh, he's offensive. Look at all the things he said. But then when someone on the left gets taken down for something fairly innocuous, the right wingers don't rush to his defense. They just say, yeah, serves him right. Fair is fair. Because you took down our guy. So do you see how this tribalism and partisanship is allowing Twitter to just knock out everybody with heterodox views and just bring everybody in? So it's, and I've fallen into this trap too, where like when, what's his, Daniel McAdams got banned from Twitter because instead of saying he thought someone's post was goofy, he said it was retarded. Or maybe he said the person was, I don't remember. And so he got banned. And so, and I said, my, you know, the issue with this is not so much that that was their policy. If they wanted to enforce that, okay. But they're obviously not doing it uniformly. Plenty of people use that word in derogatory fashion just as an insult, and they're not banned from Twitter, right? So even though I still kind of agree with my analysis there, I'm also warning in general, it's not really that we want Twitter to apply these principles uniformly. If it's crazy when it's done to our friends, that means it's a crazy principle and we should just say, stop doing it. Likewise, you know, I am never about contacting somebody's employer and trying to get them fired. Like, I mean, it would take a lot for somebody to do where I would be comfortable with, you know, yeah, let's go find out what this guy, who this guy works for, and let them know. Like, I think you'd be very curious and interested to learn that your employee was tweeting this yesterday at 11 a.m. at me. I can't, it would have to be, I don't know. I won't go there. It would be a lot. I can imagine tweets, but they would be pretty over the line. All right. So that's my analysis of Dave Chappelle's show that, oh, and the last thing just to round that train of thought. So it's the fact that he's funny, right? Because if it's partisan, just boom, boom, and just eat left and right, keep getting knocked out, and it shrinks the sphere of acceptable discourse down to the 3x5 card of acceptable, allowable opinion, as some might say. And that's not what we want, obviously. And so that's the beauty of Chappelle doing it, that he's not partisan per se. And, you know, by zinging different types of people in the act, you know, he was trying to offend everybody kind of thing. And he was pretty funny about it, right? So that's another way to really diffuse tensions and to just say, let's just test the principle here, right? That's the way to ease it in so we can look at it just, you know, the per se nature of it as opposed to the emotional baggage that goes along with being offended and very strongly disagreeing with the particular view being enunciated. And so maybe it's hard for me to stand up for that person's freedom to express that view. And again, when I say freedom, I don't mean just property rights, but you get what I'm saying. Well, that wraps up my analysis of the Dave Chappelle's Sticks and Stones. Again, if you want to see, I'll put some good clips of the stuff I mentioned in the show notes page. This is BobMurphyShow.com/60, and I will see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit BobMurphyShow.com.